It's interesting, last night and for the first half of tonight, I was sitting right at the other end of the room. Looks very different from up here, I think. I recently bought a fitness tracker. I've done 12,484 steps today, okay? And, thank you. I'm proud. And my heart rate, is 100. That says something about how I'm feeling. But one of the things that I've got quite obsessed with, because I do get obsessed about these things and my friends know it, is that it tracks my sleep patterns. If you've got one of these, you'll know this. So both the length of sleep that I actually have, but also the different stages of my sleep. So whether it's light sleep or deep sleep, REM or kind of periods of wakefulness, and you get this wonderful graph that I can kind of obsess over each day. I'm sure some of you understand. And it's kind of been really interesting for me to kind of note the relationship between the amount of deep sleep that I get and my ability to function properly the following day. I would say that the good news for you is I had good deep sleep last night, so I'm vaguely together. It's interesting to note that relationship. I'm going to come back to that later. You might be wondering what on earth is she going on about already when that's over there. Anyway, I like gadgets and I like technology, probably obvious by now. And I kind of got to musing on this and I thought, wow, wouldn't it be great if I had a similar device, if I could buy a similar device that could track my mental states, that could actually kind of, maybe set off this really loud alarm, not the nice little silent one on here, but a really loud alarm when I was about to lose it all and kind of, have a big tantrum. And then, of course, I remembered, I do, don't I? I do have this device. It's kind of inbuilt. We all have it. And it's called a mind. I just need to keep activating the awareness function on it. And off I go. So, using this wonderful, newly discovered inbuilt device that I got, what did I notice? Just last Thursday morning. So I kind of woke to a bit of sloth and torpor, accompanied by slight grumpiness. I really didn't want to get up at 6:30 in the morning. That kind of gave away to, kind of numb resignation, which was probably then followed by a very large amount of fear in meditation, subsiding into a few moments of calm, leading into a period of irritation and craving. I don't think anyone's in my community because I spied the big pile of dishes in the sink. Followed by a kind of letting go of that and some open-heartedness. I did the dishes. Followed by anxiety. I was preparing for this talk. Followed by some calm, because I kind of, for a few moments, I could let go of the idea that it had to be perfect. Followed by restlessness. I started to do doing nothing practice with a friend. But I was kind of, I want to get up and do stuff. I want to go and do this. I want to do that. Followed by some real open-heartedness and tenderness for my friend who I was sitting with. That was all before 9:50. I'd been awake for less than 4 hours. And I'm sure there were many other mental states I cycled in and out of. But those were the main ones. Those are the ones that I kind of clocked. At the arising of each of these mental states, which was obviously dependent on the conditions around me, waking up, so forth, I had a choice. I did have a choice. It didn't necessarily feel like it. But there was a kind of choice there. I could choose to simply react from that, from my mental state. So I was feeling irritated. That could have led to harsh words, or it could have led to me sulking, or I could choose to act creatively. So I actually did the washing up. I just did the washing up. When I'm acting creatively, I can become aware of my breath. I can feel my feet on the ground to try and bring a non-judgmental, kindly awareness to my experience. To remember that all things are impermanent and just kind of relax. And if I'm experiencing positive mental states, I can just try and open to them more deeply, whilst at the same time kind of accepting that they're also impermanent, that they're going to change, and not kind of lapse into suffering when that happens. So, as Sabhajyamati was just saying outside, we kind of have a choice in a way. She was talking about this more broadly last night. We have a choice whether we kind of just go into this kind of reactive, which is slightly passive mode, isn't it? It's just kind of responding, just reacting to the world around us, or move into that kind of more creative, active mode. And for me, that's really, really important to remember, because I'm not a passive creature without any kind of control over what I'm doing. I do have choice. We do have choice. So mind creates world. I think I've probably illustrated that. And that's one of the key teachings. It's one of the key teachings of the Buddha. It's fundamental to any school of Buddhism. And for me, it always reminds me of the first few verses of the Dhammapada. Dhammapada is a beautiful text written by the Buddha, and it's in verses. And I'll just read two of them. So the first two verses of the Dhammapada: experiences are preceded by mind, led by mind, and produced by mind. If one speaks or acts with an impure mind, suffering follows, even as a cartwheel follows the hoof of the ox. Experiences are preceded by mind, led by mind, and produced by mind. If one speaks or acts with a pure mind, happiness follows like a shadow that never departs. So, if I feel ill will, if I'm always looking at how I've been wronged, I'm never going to still my hatred. It's going to just keep growing. But if that isn't our mindset, if we're able to still that, if we're able to develop something more positive, then we're going to be able to dwell in that for longer, and our life will be so very different. So when I reflect on those verses, I kind of am really left with absolutely no doubt what the Buddha is telling me. So the Buddha is telling me that how I think constructs my experience of the world and my relationship with others. So if I do choose to hate other people or feel irritated by them, if I choose to think that they have wronged me, if I choose to think that other people's treatment of me justifies my anger, then I'm never going to gain freedom. I'm never going to be free. I'm going to be locked into those mental states. I will never wake up. I'm never going to move towards the stillness of the Buddha on the shrine here. Obviously, it's not only the Dhammapada that this teaching appears in. It underpins much of Buddhist teaching, and is certainly present in The Wheel of Life. If you were wondering when I was going to get onto it, I am, which we're exploring this week. And it's interesting, I've been really looking at this amazing image all week since it appeared. And I kind of realised that in preparing for this talk, I've realised that I've kind of known and I've studied The Wheel of Life since I've kind of encountered the Dharma. But I've kind of shied away from the full power of its teaching, probably in preference for more textual works. I just cited the Dhammapada. And I think that's, I was discussing this this afternoon, wasn't I, Garbhavati, that I have a view of myself of not being very visual. I don't think I'm very visually literate. I don't think I have a very visual mind. And so I've kind of shied away from it, but it's kind of been there this week, and I can't really get away from it. So it's almost that view of myself. It's another example of mind creates world. But I'm really kind of very, very drawn to it now. It's really helped me just seeing it on there. And I was reminded that in a lot of monasteries that the Wheel of Life is often just on the outside as you go into a monastery, and it's there to remind people, it's there to remind the monks and other people coming in that that's what they're trying to move away from. They're trying to move away from that to this, just as Garbhavati was saying earlier on. So the wheel of life is a symbolic representation of both our existential situation, or the problems we face in life, and in some ways it's a roadmap or a kind of manual for how we can move beyond and off the wheel of life. Talks later this week are going to focus more on that aspect of moving off the wheel of life. But what I want to really explore this evening is how, without some of the conditions that we've been trying to set up this week, without greater awareness, without transformation, without sangha, we can almost spend our whole life just going round and round and round, never really making any spiritual progress at all. Instead, almost just being continually at the mercy of our mental states. When I was thinking about earlier on, it's kind of like, I don't know, some awful computer game, isn't it? Which you kind of, I don't know, you're just going from level to level in a kind of rather random fashion. And sometimes, I don't know, you just end up in another world and then conditions change. And you can tell that's a limit of my computer game knowledge, okay? Like gadgets, like technology, not into the game so much. However, the good news, there is good news in this, is that for most people, there is a way of working with our mental states so that we're in increasingly more helpful conditions so that we can start to kind of see how we might get off the wheel of life and begin our journey on that spiral path that Sir Bhajamati was talking about last night, so we can make spiritual progress. So the wheel of life, I'm particularly talking around the six realms, so the third circle. In a way, that kind of sense of just going round and round and round, it's almost a bit like the ultimate vicious circle, isn't it? A vicious circle that is symbolic of both our past, our present, and future. So if we think about it, our past actions, whether they're bodily, of speech, or of mind, of thought, condition the present. They condition the present, which in turn conditions the future, and then in turn the future becomes the past. And so we continue just round and round that kind of ultimate vicious circle unless we can find a way to get off it. So an example from my own life that I've only really just realised. So I am 56 years old, which I know will be a surprise for some of you. 12,000 steps, don't forget. But it's only recently that I have realised that for the last 46 years, so since I was 10, I've believed a story about someone very close to me, a story that painted them in a rather poor light, and that's really affected both my view of them, but has also contributed to justifying my kind of dismissal of them in my life, justified my mistrust of them. And I only recently realised I don't actually even know if that story is true. I don't know if it's true, but I chose to believe it at the time, and I've continued to believe it because it suited me. It's only recently that I've begun to kind of question that and to see how, in relation to this particular incident, my mind, so clouded by aversion and ignorance, remember the hub in the middle, has created a particular version of the world that may bear very little relationship to reality, very little relationship, but it suited me. It's kind of suited me to continue to view this person's current actions with suspicion and mistrust, instead of the kindness and generosity that other people see in them. It's also had, I realise, major knock-on effects on my relationships with other people, because people who have had nothing to do with that original incident 46 years ago, but it's kind of had a knock-on effect of mistrust and suspicion with them. So it really kind of that the past, the present and the future, they're conditioning each other. So that story for me really highlights the way in which the kind of driving force for this circular treadmill where we go nowhere is that hub in the middle, which Sir Badger Mathy introduced us to last night, which contains the cock, the pig, and the snake, which represent the kind of the greed, the hatred, the delusion. And driven by these forces, we're locked into an existence where we're constantly kind of grabbing and grasping at the pleasurable, pushing away the unpleasant. And we do that because we're deeply deluded about our situation, deeply deluded about the true nature of reality. That doesn't mean to say that we have an awful time all the time. We don't. There's lots of pleasure. So the second circle, I need to put my glasses on because I really can't see this at all. The second circle, beyond that first one, you might see that on the left-hand side, there's kind of people going upwards. And then it's almost like they get to the point at top and then the people are tumbling down in quite a painful way. So I think that's kind of representing that we do have pleasure, we do kind of make progress, we do go up, and then at some point it all changes, conditions change, and we're kind of tumbling down again. So I want to kind of move on to these six realms going around the outside. If you weren't here last night, we do have photocopies of this image, not in colour. You can take it away, colour it, bring it back if you want to. Well, if you didn't get one last night, there are plenty, and somebody will hand them out when you go out. So those six realms that are kind of circling the hub. Now, in more traditional accounts of the Tibetan Wheel of Life, the different realms are almost seen as actual realms which we might be reborn into. And I'd say there's no sense of punishment here. There's no sense of punishment or reward implied as to the world you might be reborn into. It's merely seen as a kind of outcome of our karmic actions. So basically, in that scenario, it's kind of we live in the sort of realm that reflects who we are. There's also a second way of regarding these different realms, which directly relate to the idea that mind creates world. And in many respects, that might be more helpful for us anyway, because it's almost like one lifetime, which we kind of can circle around and round. So the different realms here are manifestations of our inner mental states, very vividly depicted. And I would kind of make a guess, I might be wrong, or maybe I should just speak for myself, but I kind of certainly know that each realm is a mental state that I have inhabited. I have lived there and paid the rent for quite some time on occasions. And I've kind of circled around and around depending on different conditions. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to go through each one and just kind of talk a little bit about each one and, maybe share a bit of my own life in them. So at the top, right at the top, kind of beautiful coloured golden light, blue skies, is the kind of divas or the god realm. Okay, we're not talking about a Christian god here. We could think of it maybe more as inhabited by angels. A world that is inhabited by gods, by angels, by beings of great beauty. And they live in this kind of really beautiful environment. So there's luscious parks and castles. Very pleasant place. So pleasure is abundant and it's effortless. You don't have to do any work for it at all. And there is no suffering. So at a mundane kind of worldly level, you could say that maybe this might be, I don't know, the extremely, extremely well off, the extremely rich, who, you know, for them they can buy absolutely anything they want. It could be the incredibly emotionally well adjusted. But there's a sense there of abundance, of a wonderful high standard of living. And at a more refined level, it can also refer to highly absorbed meditative states, so very refined aesthetic pleasure as well. Now, I'd be the first to admit that at both a mundane or even a more refined level, this all sounds rather lovely. And it's kind of like, well, who wouldn't want to live in the God realm? Yeah, I certainly do sometimes. And it might be nice. It might be very nice to spend time in there. And I wouldn't deny that at all. But its beauty hides a danger. Its beauty hides a danger. Or at least there's a danger there if we actually want to make spiritual progress, if we want to get off the wheel of life. For the beauty of this place can hide from us the wisdom of impermanence. The people who inhabit that world, they forget that they too are subject to old age, to sickness, to death, that suffering is going to happen at some point. And the other trouble with it, is that if you kind of live in a world where everything is just provided for you, it's just there, there's no work for it, nothing to do to get it, well, it can all become a little bit precious about it, really. So we kind of become almost kind of super sensitive. So it's almost like the kind of natural robustness we have of just dealing with our daily life. That no longer exists. So we're not able to face any discomfort at all. The slightest bit of discomfort will be seen as incredibly painful. So as what will happen at some point, because it will be inevitable, we kind of fall through a trapdoor and we fall into another world, into another realm, and our experience of it is going to be even stronger, our sense of pain and suffering. So let's move on around a little bit. So we're going round to our right, to the Stewers or the Titans. Now, in contrast to the God realm next door, this realm is full of anger and hatred and warfare. So people are kind of fighting with both each other, and they're often planning raids on the God realm, because I think you probably see it. There's a tree. I can't see. It's a tree going through into the... Yeah. Thank you. There's this kind of wishful-fulling gem tree, and the roots are in the Titans, and the kind of jewels are in the God realm. So those in the Titans are often kind of plotting how they can get in there and get all the jewels. So this is a realm of big competitive egos, where conflict is the norm. And people often writing about this say that, you know, we can talk about this as areas of such a business and politics and so forth. I haven't worked in business, I haven't worked in politics. I worked in academia and I can see it. Yeah. But it's perfectly possible for us to inhabit that mental state and not be involved with any of those areas. Of course it is. And there is suffering here. There is suffering here, is present as anywhere else. Even if we're kind of in fear of losing our hard-won status because of the competition and so forth. But anger and hatred are kind of underneath, incredibly painful, aren't they? If that's what we're feeling, if we're feeling a lot of ill will and pain and anger. Not kind of happy states to be in. And when I kind of think about that realm and my own experience, I think, yes, I kind of recognise it. I recognise it, and I recognise that probably for a lot of my life, for reasons I don't kind of really need to go into now, I kind of inhabited that world. I was really angry. I was angry with the world. I was angry with lots of different groups of people who I decided were all wrong, that the kind of problems of the world lay at the feet of other people. So there was a lot of anger and there was a lot of hatred. And I think it wasn't until I kind of encountered the Dharma that I really kind of started to be able to change that anger. I still feel angry, by the way. I still get angry, but it's not as strong. I don't feel I'm inhabiting that world the whole time. So then we move on further. We move round to the third one. The third one. So this is inhabited by the pretas, or the hungry ghosts. The hungry ghosts. So if you look at it, and come up and have a look at it afterwards, the landscape here is incredibly harsh and rocky and uncomfortable. There's absolutely no pleasure in it at all. There's no respite. And it's inhabited by these very sad, pitiful creatures who have these huge bellies and tiny, tiny mouths and necks. And their craving for food and drink can never really be satisfied, because even if they receive the food and drink that they want, they can't swallow it. And often it will just turn into swords or fire in their mouth, and so increases their pain. So we can certainly say that this is the world of neurotic craving, of addiction. And that might kind of seem kind of almost very obvious. But it can also be much more subtle than that. It's much more subtle than that. Because at the heart of it, there is a kind of ceaseless searching outside of ourselves for something, anything, that is kind of going to bring us a lasting satisfaction. But of course, it never can. It never can. And that's what that's really trying to depict. And Sabhajamati was just talking about kind of, you know, the way a kind of very consumer-orientated society kind of grabs us in all the time, and encourages, it's dependent upon that hungry ghost within us. And I kind of thinking around that, I think, yeah, and it's two sides to it, isn't it? Because, yes, it's almost easy to kind of blame an advertising industry, big business, capitalism, whatever we want to label it, so we could blame the guys above us if we wanted to. But it's the hungry ghosts that also keep it going. We keep it going because we engage in it. We engage in it. So when I think about that realm, it has a kind of very visceral effect on me. I kind of feel this, I kind of feel a deep sense of compassion, a deep sense of compassion for people who find themselves just stuck in that realm, just stuck in it, whether it's through addiction or just this endless searching for something. And I think it's because I also recognise myself in that. I recognise myself. So alongside my anger, I have a great deal of greed and craving. I think we all do. And I think that, you know, in the past, I've had a lifestyle, I've had a career that's kind of enabled me to indulge that, to really indulge that. And I think that, you know, I was forever kind of spending money in this desperate attempt to kind of think, well, the next thing I buy, that will kind of make me happy, that will kind of fill something inside me that's deeply missing. News is it didn't. I just ended up deeply in debt. I ended up deeply in debt, which I had to pay off. It was a hard lesson to learn, but I actually think it was a really important lesson to learn. And again, encountering the Dharma, I could really start to see the roots of that, the conditions that had led to that kind of craving. And again, craving happens for me all the time. Vidyadharka was saying something about the other day about on the regulars morning about if you go to Westfield, we'll just watch your craving kind of rise up. It's a bit like a barometer, isn't it? Maybe I could get something on my fitness tracker for that. But I know it. If I go to those, but I can see it. I can suddenly think, oh, I want that. I need that. My life will be complete with that. It won't. It really won't. So yeah, the hungry ghost realm, which I think we can all inhabit. Okay, we come down to the bottom. So at the top we've got the gods, we've got the heaven realm up there, and at the bottom we've got the hell realm. We've got the hell realm. And there's a big ugly monster in there. And it's at the bottom of the circle. It's not unsurprising that it's there. It's indicative that we've kind of really reached rock bottom. It really is a kind of, we're living in a hell realm. And that's going to be different for each of us. But it represents different states of extreme psychological and emotional suffering. So whether that's shame, deep shame, or guilt, self-loathing, fear, and of course mental illness as well. And obviously some people will live in that realm all the time. They live in it all the time, or it's their predominant experience. And again, I just think, well, that people just deserve compassion. If they feel like they're living in a hell. Yeah. And we can have empathy. Because we probably also know what it's like. To kind of be in that realm. Even if for short periods of time, we've probably all had some experience of it. And it can feel so painful, can't it? We can just feel so disconnected, so separate, so isolated from other people. And I was thinking again about, I would have thought at one time, I've never lived in a hell realm. It's never been that bad. But I was kind of thinking of something that Sabhajamati was saying last night around how Bhante Sangharakshita, the founder of our movement, was saying that if we go back to that inner circle, that maybe there should be a fourth animal there of fear. And I was thinking about that, and I was thinking, oh, if I think about my kind of anger and my greed, yes, it's deluded. I have a deluded sense of reality. But underpinning it is fear. So if I kind of lose some of the anger, some of the greed, some of the craving kind of eases off, I think what comes up for me is fear. And I kind of realise that in many ways that landscape of fear has been kind of quite strong in my life. It's been quite strong in my life for lots of different conditions that I don't kind of really need to kind of talk about at the moment. But it's kind of been there, and it's kind of stopped me doing so much in my life. It's stopped me, well, I talked earlier on about having mistrust in somebody, and it's kind of that fear kind of lends a mistrust in myself, it lends a mistrust in other people, a confidence in my world, and sometimes just an inability to be with myself. And again, I'm sure I'm not the only person that can feel like that. And this is where I come back to the fitness tracker. There was a point to it. So as I said, deep sleep, it measures deep sleep, and we know that deep sleep's really, really important for us because it helps to kind of clean our brain and keeps us functioning and so forth, and will affect my positive mental states or my mental states. So they'll either be positive or negative, and one of the conditions for that is deep sleep. And the reason why I've got so obsessed with measuring it is because I realise I stop myself from having deep sleep because I kind of avoid going to sleep at night so I can watch things on my iPad, see, another piece of technology, which kind of then, when I go to sleep, I don't go into deep sleep. It's been shown that if we watch screens late at night, we don't go into deep sleep. And I realise the reason I do that, I've gotten to this awful pattern of doing it, is because I'm fearing going to sleep. And that comes from very, very old kind of conditioning when I was a child. So I can kind of see that, yeah, I have inhabited that realm. Moving on, we're getting there. So the animal realm. So I just want to kind of say, first of all, when I'm talking about the animal realm, I'm not talking about your beloved cat, okay? or your beloved dog, we know are kind of just really, really wise, wise creatures, okay? I have a cat in my community and we all know that she's wiser than the rest of us, so I'm not talking about your cat. What I am talking about, though, with the animal realm, is being in mental states where we aren't able to think or reflect, and we just act from our instinctual drives. We're seeking out satisfaction through, I don't know, food or drink or sex or other sensory pleasures. We're just kind of going for them without any thought. And that might be very pleasant for a while. But ultimately, it's not satisfying because we're at the mercy. We're just at the mercy of events. There's no conscious choice or planning there. There's a lack of intelligence, culture, or forethought. So the animal realm. And then finally, as we move up, and I kind of almost want to breathe a sigh of relief, we come to the human realm, which is next to the God realm, in between the animal and the God realm. So this is seen as the best realm for making spiritual progress. It's still part of the wheel. But if we're able to dwell in here for longer and longer periods of time, we can start to make spiritual progress. And eventually we can find a way out of the human realm and up on that spiral path that Sabhadramati was talking about last night. Now, in the human realm, people are doing lots of different things. They're kind of doing work and getting on with life, and there's meditating and just all sorts of things going on there. And in the human realm, we will experience the mental states of the other realm, So we will experience anger and greed and fear and all those things, but they're not going to be as strong or as powerful upon us. So for example, we might experience the beauty and the pleasure of the God realm. We kind of need beauty and pleasure in our life, but we have a robustness, so we don't become too precious about our pleasure, so that when it fades away, we can cope with that. We're not kind of devastated. We can cope with that discomfort without it destroying us. And that's really, really important, because one of the biggest hindrances in our spiritual practice is that we want to get in and stay in the God realm. We think, that's where it is. That's where I want to be. And as I said earlier on, it's not. It's not where we want to be. And again, I kind of see myself doing that all the time, particularly if I'm on a long retreat. I have kind of perhaps really deep, concentrated meditation, and that's it, I'm off chasing it. That's what I want. So I think the key point here, relating it back to what we're doing here, is that we need to be prepared to make effort in our spiritual life. We need challenges to help us keep growing. And that's what we get in the human realm. We get challenges and we can see that and we can make progress. So by experiencing things, but not such like we're just living in something, we can learn to deal with them. We can learn to move from that more reactive to the creative mind. So this is starting to kind of come to the end. That human realm, I think, is so important. It's almost like that's, if there's a kind of purpose to this, that's what we're trying to do. We're trying to get there. We're trying to get into the human realm. And I think that's very often why, when people first kind of start in their spiritual life, and one of the things that we kind of often emphasise here, and I know that Sangharakshita kind of, I found it very powerful to read about him saying this, is that very often what we need to pay urgent attention to at the beginning, when we first start practicing, is to work on becoming a happy, healthy human being. So somebody who isn't constantly being pushed and pulled around by our mental states, where we have a sense of responsibility for ourselves, where we feel that we have some control over who we are. Hence the importance of the meditation practices that we teach here, all the things that we're doing here this week on the Urban Retreat. They're helping us to deepen existing positivity so we can access that more and more for longer periods of time. So, yeah, just to kind of draw to a close, what I want to say though is that it might feel, that feels great, but I'm stuck over here. I'm kind of stuck in this angry realm, or I'm stuck in this kind of hungry ghost realm. What on earth am I going to do about it? The human realm feels a kind of, I don't know, a million miles away from where I want to be. And I kind of understand that. I really can understand that. But what you'll notice is in each of the realms, there's a Buddha. There's a Buddha figure in each of the realms. And this is really, really important because each of the Buddhas is offering something that the people in that realm actually need to help them to actually move, to help them to actually move. So, for example, in the God realm, the Buddha is actually playing the music of impermanence. So we kind of realise that people in the God realm, they need something really beautiful to waken them up. They can't be woken up just boom, like that. So they have the music of impermanence to remind them that all things will actually end. In the Titans, in the kind of angry world, we have a Buddha. It's got a sword. We might think, that doesn't feel very Buddha-like. But it's the sword of wisdom that is conquering, cutting through the forces of ignorance. In the Hungry Ghost, in the Hell realm, people are being offered what they need. They're being offered food that kind of sustains them. They're being offered nectar that kind of soothes their suffering. In the animal realm, the Buddha brings the gift of culture, of communication and language, because without that, we can't move forward. We can't practice the Dharma. There's no ability to empathize with others and so on. And finally, in the human realm, there is the figure of a holy man going forth with a begging bowl. There's a historical Buddha in the human realm, representative of everything that the Buddha achieved, everything that the Sangha that has come from the Buddha has achieved. And it's saying to us that this is where we really can make progress. We really can make progress and start to kind of realise our full potential for wisdom and compassion. And to me, when I look at that, when I think about there's so many meanings we can draw from those Buddhas. And incidentally, I would just kind of say that another aspect of this is that if we're down in the hell realm or the kind of hungry ghost realm, those are often the realms where we can make the most spiritual progress. So there's this other idea that goes with the Wheel of Life where there are Buddha seeds. Yeah, so if there's more Buddha seeds in a particular realm, then there is a greater chance for progress, And in the hell realm, there's quite a lot of Buddha seeds because it's almost like we can go no further. And people inhabiting that realm often have a desire for freedom and have, you know, they have almost like the best chance of enlightenment because they can go nowhere else. Up in the God realm, there's a single Buddha seed. So if you still want to go in there, it's just not going to work. But when I think about those Buddhas, what I really kind of think about is the refuges and precepts that we chant. And for me, those Buddhas are kind of saying, we can all go for refuge. We can go for refuge to the Buddha, to the Dharma, the teaching of the Buddha, and to the Sangha. And it's that kind of will help us to get off this wheel of life. Thank you.